Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm Bill Nigut. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. With us today, we have an all-AJC panel today, which I think is wonderful. With us, after way too long an absence, the political writer for the AJC, Jim Galloway. You have been in Cleveland, Philadelphia, and who knows where.
We're going to see if I can remember how to talk.
I bet you can. Also joining us in the studio, political reporter for the AJC, Aaron Gould-Chinen. And on the phone, we're really happy to welcome back to the show the Washington correspondent for the Constitution, Tamar Hallerman. Hi, Tamar. Are you there? She's not here yet. Okay. She'll be joining us in the next few minutes. And in fact, that gives me time to make a couple of quick announcements. The first one is this. We're going to try something a little different with Political Rewind in a few weeks, because the voice of the voter is what really is starting to count more than ever as the election looms upon us. We're going to put together a show that represents voters of Georgia. We want to do essentially a little focus group, and we're inviting some of our listeners who may want to be on that show talking about the presidential race, politics in the state of Georgia, and other political matters, to call us up and tell us why they'd like to be a part of that show. So I'm going to give the number now. It's a recorded line. If you call this line, you can leave a message. You can tell us why you'd like to be on the show. Please keep your message short, because if you go on for a long time on the phone, we'll worry that you'll go on too long if you're on the air with us. So the number is 678-757-4472. 678-757-4472. That's 4GPB, just to make it somewhat easier for you. We'll give the number out again later in the show. But call and leave your name. Give us contact information. And we may pick you to be one of the people on our focus group in a few weeks here on Political Rewind. Tamar, you're now with us, huh?
Sure. How are you?
Great. Thank you for joining us from Washington.
Thank you.
So we've got Jim Galloway and Aaron Gould-Chinen in the studio. And I think, look, we know this has been a week of Trump. Trump has obviously dominated the headlines. And there are so many things that we can talk about in that regard. But Jim Galloway, you broke a really interesting story on the Political Insider blog a little while ago that I think we should give you a second to talk about, because this is a whole new, with all the talk now about Republicans saying, you know, maybe we can't support this guy, you have a whole new front in this.
This could be a whole new national obsession that could carry us through November 8th. And that is, you've got, we don't elect presidents directly. We elect electors, presidential electors, and they choose, they become members of the Electoral College, and they vote in December to ratify the decision of the states, okay? You've got 16 electors, Republican electors, were chosen to represent Donald Trump. One of them is a fellow named Bauke Vu of Decatur. Long time, very, very reliable Republican activist. His family fled Saigon in 75. He put out a statement today that says he can, just given Donald Trump's statements on Khazir Khan, the Muslim father of a soldier killed in Iraq, he can't vote for Donald Trump in November. So I called him up and I said, I said, Bauke, you're an elector too. What would you do in December? And he says, I'm thinking about it. I may not vote for him. I have the right to write in whatever name I choose if I don't. Georgia is one of, I think, 21 states that don't require members of the Electoral College to vote the way their party does, or their state does in November. So you could be opening up a whole new discussion here about what's called the faithless elector.
You know what's fascinating about that, aside from just the statement, in itself is there are a number of Republican leaders who we are led to believe would like to be able to back away from Donald Trump, but feel they can't because they see their political futures being at stake. Here's a guy who doesn't have a political, well, he may or may not have a political future at stake, but certainly not the top of his mind in this sort of thing, right?
Right, right. His wife, by the way, was an alternate delegate to the Cleveland convention, and he was up in Cleveland, and he did watch Donald Trump, and he just wasn't impressed.
She was a delegate for Marco Rubio, right?
Yes.
Not for Donald Trump, which says a
right.
lot also.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see whether anybody thinking it would be time to poll the Georgia Trump electors? Let's point out that there's a slate of Clinton electors, too. Let's just make it clear that we have that going on. But it might be interesting to poll these guys.
I think that's a great idea. Like, it's a really wonderful idea to see how many other people are on that list or having second thoughts now, too. Because you see it more and more, especially on social media, of what you might call more moderate or mainstream Republicans pushing back at the idea of supporting Trump. And we have plans to check in with a lot of those folks later to see, you know, if they've come to a decision of what they're actually going to do. But
this,
the electors.
It sounds like the potential to be a national story when you've got an elector
If you're talking about a very tight electoral college race and you have a scattering of, say, even five electors across the nation, who could make the difference?
So there's that. Similarly, Tamar, your name, you're one of the people on, who's got a byline on a story today, and Jim, you are too. So Tamar, let me start with you. Johnny Isaacson has now spoken out in terms of the comments that Trump has gotten into such hot water over talking about the family of Humayun Khan, the army captain who was killed in Iraq. What did Isaacson say?
So this is a pretty carefully worded statement, and when you look at it, you see that Donald Trump's name is nowhere on it, and that's a very critical thing to keep in mind. Johnny Isaacson, he's running in November. He wants a third term in the Senate. He has endorsed Trump, but he's also kind of made sure to stay an arm's distance away. He realizes that you know, this might be a kind of controversial choice, so he's trying to keep himself separate. In this statement that he put out, he's more talking about his role as chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and it talks about the life of Captain Khan, who died in 2004, how he made a sacrifice for the country, and Senator Isaacson's talking more about how he's committed to honoring fallen soldiers and that sort of thing. So he clearly thinks that's the winning issue for him, as opposed to commenting directly on Trump.
I think you're going to hear a little bit more about that lately.
What does that mean?
Well, I don't think that Isaacson is going to be allowed to control the response on that. I think you already see some Democrats lining up to press Isaacson, and I'm sure it'll be a TV spot at some point. You know, do you or do you not support Donald Trump, and do you support the statement A, statement B, statement C, statement D?
Yeah,
it's
going to
happen.
Yeah, you've sort of anticipated a question I was going to ask, and you've already said it, this was a statement, not a response to a question that a reporter posed to Johnny Isaacson. And this is right. The next step is questions.
Well, a lot of this is going to be really interesting if and when Senator Isaacson agrees to debate Jim Barksdale. As you know, Jim Barksdale, the Democratic candidate, has called for six debates between the two across the state between now and November. And if Senator Isaacson agrees to that or agrees to any debates, yeah, you can guarantee that he's going to get asked that question. And one would hope that whomever moderates those debates would not allow a statement like what his office issued today to go unchallenged.
You know, the Democratic convention, Aaron and Jim, you were both up there, began to set the stage for the kind of questioning you're suggesting now. There were a couple of programs that took place on a couple of nights in which speakers made the point, you need to go back and ask your member of Congress, your incumbent senator, your other state elected officials, Republicans, are they going to support Donald Trump? They laid the groundwork in Philadelphia for just this kind of questioning last week, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've seen some payoff on it already, where a congressman from New York has come out and said that he's going to support Hillary Clinton. You've got Meg Whitman from California, who said she's going to support Hillary Clinton. And there was evidence of an email train between Mrs. Clinton and others where she was reaching out to Republicans to try and actually solicit support from them. So it's not a surprise that the Democrats did this.
No, no, but when we talked on Friday after the convention was over, Bill, everybody was pointing out that this was kind of the Philly was so patriotic, it almost seemed like a Republican convention. And that was one message. But the other message that Democrats, and particularly Barack Obama, has begun to really press home this week is that Republicans have nominated an unqualified candidate. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the Democratic mantra. And that's what Republican candidates like Isaacson are going to be hit with from between now and November.
What's interesting with the Republicans is how much, the Democrats are really trying to go after this national security angle. They clearly think that's where the advantage is going to be with them, with some of these centrist, more traditional establishment Republicans. And you saw a new ad out today, Republicans against Trump, a 30-second spot with quotes from the former CIA director under President Bush, talking about how somebody like Trump should not be having the nuclear code. So I think we're going to see that line of attack a little bit more from Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. Tomorrow, Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe made a statement this morning. We have taken, I guess, at face value, that was somewhat chilling in this same area of concern, suggesting that Trump was asking in one of his first national security briefings, why we had hesitated to use a nuclear arsenal in some of the conflagrations that we've been involved with. Do you know about that story, Tamar?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that, and that's certainly an interesting argument. It's something that President Obama mentioned yesterday in his strong rebuke of Trump, talking about how he's unfit to serve as president, and I believe the quote was woefully unprepared. And he is talking about things like nukes and the national security aspect of being a commander-in-chief.
Yeah, I mean, the notion that Donald Trump, a candidate for president, may have asked a national security advisor, why don't we consider using nukes, is another step.
The Trump campaign has jumped out and denied that this
okay.
was ever the case.
Gotcha. Okay, good. Okay, that sounds fair. Tomorrow, we haven't heard, I know they've been in recess, so we have not heard anything from the Georgia senator who really jumped on the Trump train early, David Perdue, right?
Yeah, exactly. This is a time when members of Congress, they take the time to go tour around their home districts. Some people take some time off. So I think a lot of Trump supporters are probably pretty happy that, they're not being hounded daily by the Washington press corps.
Yeah.
And we haven't heard anything directly from Perdue. We reached out to his spokeswoman today, and she confirmed that he does indeed still support Trump. And the statement that we got also kind of points this back toward the media. They're saying this is another media distraction, something that came straight from the Hillary Clinton campaign. But they also, on the other hand, did underscore that Captain Khan is a, quote, American hero. So breaking with Trump a little bit there, but still kind of framing it in that, in this argument that we always see, oh, it's the media's fault, it's Hillary Clinton's fault, why this is such a big deal.
Jim, let's go back a step on all of this, and we'll try to unwind some of what, or unpack some of the things that people out there in our listening audience who are very interested in politics have been hearing, of course, all week. But it's been a terrible week for Trump. I think his people even admit that, most of the people who talk quietly behind the scenes who are part of that campaign. But let's put it, before we even talk about some of the specifics, you guys are in the field right now at the AJC conducting a poll.
Right.
Which is fascinating. How many nights are your people in the field? Do you happen to know, or Aaron, do you know?
I started last night. We'll go through Thursday night.
Okay, so you are going to get a really good sample of people who have watched these developments over the last few days, and I'm really excited that Friday we're going to get to share some of those figures, thanks to you all, with our listeners. But so speculate at this point, and tomorrow you jump in too. What impact do we think this is maybe having on this red state of Georgia? If Georgia is a Trump state, they voted for him overwhelmingly here in the Republican primary. Are his messages just reinforcing to the base what they want to hear?
Well, I think there's a couple things that we need to keep in mind here. One is that, yeah, he is speaking directly to the base of rural white Republican voters. And I think you'll see it still be remarkably close. Every other poll so far has. But the other thing that we're doing is we're asking both the question of head-to-head Hillary versus Trump, but we're also asking another question where you've got Clinton, Trump, Gary Johnson, and Jill Stein. So it would be fascinating to see if...
Jill Stein, the Green Party.
Correct, right.
And Gary Johnson, the Libertarian.
Right. Thank you. So it would be fascinating to me to see if in the direct head-to-head between Hillary and Trump, if she's doing much better than she is in a four-way field, which would indicate that some of those votes are siphoning off when they have other options.
Right, yeah. And intensity is going to be a very important factor in this. I mean, and that's one thing you have to remember, that's what the conventions were all about. Conventions were, on one hand, about speaking to your base and then reaching out to kind of toward the middle that you were looking for. Gallup had one poll out this week that I thought was very interesting, and that it found that for the first time, when it asked voters about what they saw and heard in Cleveland, where Republicans met, they said, for the first time, they said they were less likely as a whole to vote for Trump after they watched that convention than before. You don't see that happen very often. And I think you might see that kind of play out in if not in our poll, then maybe others down the line. It's the intensity that goes missing.
The thing that I'm really interested in seeing in this poll is what independents in Georgia thinks. Because, you know, to a certain extent, a lot of the things that Trump says, it doesn't bother his base. That's exactly why they picked him in the primary over some of these more establishment Republicans. But these independents, who make up one of Georgia's biggest voting blocks, they are the key to Georgia. And typically, they tend to lean Republican. But what we saw in the WSB poll that came out earlier this week is that they were breaking for Clinton. By a little bit. So I'm going to be very curious to see whether that has shifted a little bit over the last few days.
All right. I'll tell you what I'd love to do. I do want to go into some of the Trump week and put a Georgia lens on it when we can. I also want to put a historical lens on it at some point. There have been people this week who, in watching the fight, and that's really what it's become between Khizr Khan and Donald Trump, have thought back to the Army McCarthy hearings in 1954. And we're going to set that up a little and play a little of the exchange that started to unravel Joe McCarthy and his anti-communist crusade in the 50s. But in the meantime, you're listening to Political Rewind. It's 2:23 on Wednesday afternoon, back after this break.
Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote the definitive book about the O.J. Simpson trial, has a new book about Patricia Hearst, the newspaper heiress who in 1974 was kidnapped by the incoherent radical group the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army. On the next Fresh Air, Toobin talks about Hearst's kidnapping and trial and where they fit in the culture and politics of the 70s. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much.
I think we got to vote on whether that is one of the great Beatles songs. Answer, absolutely. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Again, if you're interested in joining us as an informal focus group to talk about the presidential election, the issues, the candidates, we're going to put together a show in a few weeks, and we're looking to see if some of you in our audience want to be part of it. You should call us at 678-757-4472. It's a recorded message, but you should tell us why you think you'd be a good member of that panel. Keep your message short. Long messages, you'll never make the show. But leave us contact information, and we'll take it from there. 678-757-4472. With us today, thank goodness he's back in the studio, Jim Galloway, political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Oversees the Political Insider blog, and is seen in the hardcore
You
should only wish that would help circulation in the Dead Tree edition of the paper on Thursdays and Sundays. Errol Gould-Chinen, political reporter at the paper, and Tamar Hallerman, who is the Washington Courier. We have got AJC brain power in the house. We're really happy.
Aaron appears in the PG-rated portion of the paper.
So let's move into one of the controversies. This is actually the most recent one that I'm aware of. Donald Trump yesterday was at a rally in Virginia, I believe, and he wanted to let the crowd know, because he really is, to some extent, I think, trying to head off the anger that veterans seem to be feeling about him right now, and we'll get into that a little bit. He wanted the crowd to know that he had been approached by a veteran who gave him a very special gift. And here's what Trump told the crowd.
A man came up to me and he handed me his Purple Heart. Now I said to him, is that like the real one or is that a copy? And he said, that's my real Purple Heart. I have such confidence in you. And I said, man, that's like big stuff. I always wanted to get the Purple Heart. This was much easier.
Jim Galloway, what did we learn subsequent to this? Aaron?
That he's tone deaf.
The interview, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have made it a quiz. I apologize. This guy was interviewed afterward.
Right.
And he said, I didn't tell him it was Erie. I told him it was a copy. This Trump just made it up out of whole cloth. This was a copy of the Purple Heart.
Well, first of all, listening to that exchange, you got to wonder, that was his first question to the guy. You know, not how did you earn it? Why are you giving it to me? But is this the real one or is this just a copy?
Yeah.
That really stood out to me.
It was, if we've got there's an interesting shift building here that we have to go back to Philly and the patriotism issue in that ever since since the mid-70s, since we went to a volunteer army, it's always been a matter of which political party does the military belong to. And it's for so long, it's been the Republican Party. But that kind of, because they've expressed that degree of familiarity. This shows absolutely no familiarity with military culture, and so you've got that break that's happening. Moreover, you've got a situation building within the military where your ex-military people, your population, is becoming far less white, much younger, much more minority-driven, and it's not naturally falling to the Republicans anymore.
That's right. And, Tamar, in much the same way that the Republican convention gave the Democrats room to suddenly embrace patriotism in Philadelphia last week and reclaim the USA chant for their own, in some ways, Donald Trump, in his fight with the cons, has really stepped all over what, first of all, he said is one of his most important points, which is I'm there for the veterans. But as Jim says, the Republican Party's outreach to veterans, they're the party that supports our vets, yeah?
Yeah, and it's been interesting to see. We saw a few weeks back his claim that, he donated all this money to veterans groups and how he didn't want it to get out, but the evil, heartless media kind of exposed it. But you're watching the Washington Post try and track this. And, on Twitter, the reporter's posting that he hasn't found any organization who Donald Trump has given this promised $1 million to. So, it's going to be interesting to see how much that impacts a lot of these veterans who, a lot of them seemed very enthusiastic about Trump, at least at the beginning.
Yeah, and the veterans, it's sort of like, you don't want to get the veterans mad at you. They represent, something like 30 million Americans are veterans. And
something like 8% of Georgia.
Oh, that's a great point. Of course we have a lot of military veterans in this state. I hadn't even thought about that. Thank you for reminding us of that. So the other thing, of course, that Trump said in that is, I always wanted a Purple Heart. I always wanted a Purple Heart. The medal that's given in the case of injury or death. Just within the last hours, maybe yesterday or last night, a veteran made a video that is now going viral, responding to Donald Trump. Here, let's listen to it.
Hi, everybody. Will Fisher, Iraq War veteran and United States Marine. Recently, during a speech, Donald Trump remarked that he had always wanted a Purple Heart. Well, on the 19th of August, 2004, I was awarded a Purple Heart. And my brother who lost half an arm that day, he was awarded a Purple Heart. And my brother who lost an eye that day, he was awarded a Purple Heart. And my brother who was killed that day, he was awarded a Purple Heart. Purple Hearts equal bad days, Donald, and nobody, nobody with one ever wanted it.
Aaron?
That's really powerful, but I think this all goes back to Trump's unscriptedness, right? No rational person or campaign person would allow him to go up on stage and say those things. So he's speaking off the cuff, like you said, trying to connect with veterans, with military folks, to get past this con situation, and said what the first thing that came into his head is the only thing I can imagine about this situation. And, you know, it's what people love about him, his spontaneity, his extemporaneous speaking style, but it also is just causing him untold amount of heartburn.
Well, it's becoming increasingly clear that for better or worse, this is what he's going with in this general election campaign, isn't it? I mean, you know, there's this, you have a story that, in fact, you were working on a revision of it as we were set to go on the air, that about a powwow, an intervention, so to speak, that some Republicans are trying to make. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the NBC News reported today that our own Newt Gingrich, Rudy Giuliani, and Reince Priebus, thank you, were scheduling an intervention or trying to schedule an intervention with the candidate in New York to do a dramatic reset of the campaign. Newt Gingrich later emailed to the New York Times to say there is no intervention, but it's not clear whether or not that meant that there was never talk of an intervention or that the candidate refused to do it.
Yeah. Tamar, here's an interesting note to all of this. Of course, we know that in an interview with the Washington Post yesterday, Trump essentially refused to endorse Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. He went after Senator Kelly Ayotte, who's in a tough reelection battle in New Hampshire. He essentially trash-talked John McCain, who's in probably the hardest fight of his entire career, a primary battle in Arizona. But here's what I think is interesting. It was after that interview that Reince Priebus, who has, you know, Reince Priebus has tried to be the guy who stood behind Trump and said, we got to get behind him, folks. Now he is reported to be apoplectic. The Muslim ban, all the other stuff doesn't seem to matter. But now that Trump is trash-talking Republican candidates, Priebus seems to be engaged.
Exactly. And part of it also, you know, that a lot of people don't realize is he's a longtime friend of Paul Ryan. They're both from Wisconsin.
Right.
And so he slighted his friend. And on top of that, you know, it's pretty unprecedented for your party's nominee to slam your party's Speaker of the House. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that. So how do you proceed after that, especially when there are so many down ballot candidates, when control of the Senate is at stake here?
And that's what the crux of this is. I mean, a presidential campaign like this is a team sport. You know, Johnny Isaacson isn't endorsing Donald Trump just because he's in love with Johnny Isaacson. Johnny Isaacson needs the voters that Trump brings to the polls, and vice versa. So Johnny Isaacson can keep his job, so Republicans can keep control of the Senate. So when you have a presidential candidate who is dissing one of your most esteemed members of the Senate, you've got other members of the Senate saying, hey, just a minute, we didn't want Ted Cruz because he was not a team player, and look what we've got now.
See, this is one of those situations where I think Trump knows his base, though. Because they'll pretty much, you know, the only thing less popular than Donald Trump a lot these days is Congress. And certainly the establishment of Paul Ryan, John McCain, are not popular with the people who really support Donald Trump. And, you know, whether he meant to do it this way or not, but I think what he did do by saying that is get a lot of that base back on his side.
An interesting concept is this idea of what people have been calling an exit ramp. Perhaps for skittish Republicans running for re-election who might have endorsed Trump in the past, but now are becoming increasingly concerned by some of the things he's been saying, whether that be about the Khan family, whether that be about veterans. A lot of people are starting to openly wonder whether this is the final straw, whether this provides enough political cover for some of these Republicans.
Well, I will tell you what, it's going to, I think it will be determined in large part as to far as to how Paul Ryan performs in his primary. I don't think there's really a problem there. But most important, John McCain. If John McCain and McCain loses his primary, I'm wondering if you've got a whole Senate that's going to take another look at this bargain that they've struck.
Well, you know, I wonder. Okay, so I think you're right, Jim. Based on the polls I've been polling, I'm seeing, and tomorrow you may know, that Wisconsin polling seems to indicate that Paul Ryan is going to win his reelection campaign. So here's my question. Let's speculate. After he secures his berth in the general, and I don't, Tamar, do you know what kind of general opposition Paul Ryan has up there? I don't.
Okay. Off the top of my head.
Okay, so I don't know whether he has a significant Democrat facing him or not. But okay, so one scenario is he wins this, we know he seems safe heading back to the House and his speakership. Does he, after the election, say, I've had it, I can't continue to support this guy? Or does he have to continue supporting him because of all of his members who are still in trouble?
I think he'd have to whip that vote pretty hard in his own caucus to find out how popular of an idea that would be first.
That's fascinating. It's a really fascinating question out there.
But McCain does have significant, I mean, very significant Democratic opposition.
Right, right.
And that is a problem. And he is one of these, he's like Mark Kirk in Illinois. Kelly Ayotte that we mentioned in New Hampshire, they could be the margin between controlling the Senate and not controlling
exactly.
It.
Exactly. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, PoliticsGPB, if you want to join the conversation. And we are getting tweets from some of you already. Trump thinks he paid the ultimate price. That's what he ought to get paid for his shady real estate deals. Ted B says that there's nothing about vet groups to check and find out if, in fact, they're turning on Donald Trump. I think we've seen a lot of reporting that suggests they are. Richard Flynn says he thinks that Trump will put Georgia back in place. So tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Tamar, to the extent that I guess the Hill is a ghost town right now, can you sort of, in terms of people who are up there and the climate up there, can you kind of give us a little overview, a sense of what's going on in Washington? How unsettled are the Republicans that you're running into about all of the stuff that's happening?
Quite a bit. Everybody seems to be glued to Twitter and to cable news to see what the latest is when it comes to all of this. But when it comes to the political class on the Republican side, a lot of people are freaked out. Some people are even saying, I told you so. So it's interesting to watch. Everybody's, you know, as gripped to this, as gripped with this as the reporters are.
Yeah, well, I'll bet they are. It's going to be
The thing you have to remember is us reporters, our jobs are secure, whether mostly, whether depending on it doesn't matter who wins in November. You've got a whole political class whose livelihood is based on a November outcome.
All right, go ahead, Tamar.
Well, tying into this, it's a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's important. Two congressional races recently where the establishment on the Republican side has actually done well. So it proves that you know, they might not be dying yet. We saw this Kansas primary overnight where a member of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus went down. And even here in Georgia the week before, we saw West Point Mayor Drew Ferguson win Lynn Westmoreland's seat in West Georgia over a much more conservative candidate. Maybe this is the return of the establishment. There is some optimism when it comes to the congressional side.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you mentioned the Kansas race. I was going to bring it up at some point. Tim Huelskamp, who is a real Tea Party favorite out there, I mean, he's one of the leaders of the Tea Party movement out there, and he's been hailed for being a kind of a Ted Cruz sort of member, in the sense that he follows his own voice. He doesn't listen to the establishment. Kicked off the Agriculture Committee because he wasn't playing ball. And that, more than anything else, may have had an impact on his reelection. Nevertheless, you're right, Tamar. Suddenly we see a guy who's embraced by the social conservatives who cannot win an election in his home district. And you do have to wonder if that's a bellwether for anything.
Yeah, I think also you have to remember that there was talk out of Kansas last night that it was a sort of rejection of the Sam Brownback revolution from a few years ago. The governor there seemed to be losing a lot of popularity, and voters in Kansas reacted pretty strongly yesterday.
Yeah, the state Senate majority leader was ousted, and I think 11 incumbent Republican state lawmakers.
Yeah.
All right, let's do this. It's 2:41 on Wednesday afternoon. I think we should get our final break in and then come back. We're going to talk a bit more. I do want to play a little bit of that Army-McCarthy hearing with Joe Welch and Joe McCarthy right after this break. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB Radio.
Ami Eubanks Davis thought her job was done when her hardworking students graduated from college. But then she watched as they failed to get into the professional world.
They weren't getting those skills and access to networks simply because of who they were born to and where they were born.
So she decided to do something about it. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Hi, we're back on Political Rewind at 2:42 in the afternoon. I'm really happy to have part of the AJC Political Brain Trust on the show today.
Aaron, we prefer to say the better third.
The voice of Jim Galloway. Don't you agree with me? It's been far too long since we've had him here in the studio with us. We're so glad he's back from the Republican convention in Cleveland or Democratic convention in Philadelphia. Aaron Gould Shinen, who reported from the convention, Democrats in Philadelphia. And Tamar Hallerman, who is just as Congress gets set to come back. When do they come back, Tamar?
Second week of September.
Okay, you got a while yet, but you're just going to have the time of your life up there once they get back.
Delightful.
As the election plays out. Once again, if you want to be part of the Political Rewind focus group, informal focus group that we're going to do, call us at 678-757-4472. We've gotten a lot of calls already, Jenny Ahmed tells me. Just leave a message. Tell us why you should be part of our focus group panel talking about presidential politics. Leave us a contact number or email, and we'll get back to you, and we'll take it from there. 678-757-4472. All right. Y'all want to talk history for a minute?
Let's go.
All right. So in the past week, since the terribly moving speech, and I think Republicans and Democrats agreed that it was a moving speech that Khazir Khan made at the Democratic convention, talking about his son, Humayun Khan, the army captain killed in Iraq. And since the way in which Donald Trump has chosen to push back, to argue with him, to in some ways defame him and his wife. There have been some people who have said this reminds them of the moment in the spring of 1954 when McCarthyism was flourishing. Joe McCarthy, senator from Wisconsin, on his anti-communist witch hunt in government, in the film industry, in television. He, of course, was the one who essentially gave life to the Hollywood blacklist in the early 50s, had people turning on each other, testifying against each other. It was a horrible period, horrible chapter in our lives. And I think it's fair to say, Jim Galloway, that McCarthy was a demagogue of the worst sort.
Yes. He brought us to the edge of something unpleasant.
So there were two turning points. One was Edward R. Murrow, who did a broadcast on See It Now in which he kind of unraveled some of the claims that have been made that McCarthy was making. But then there was another turning point. And without going into the great details of the hearing, there was a day in a hearing in Washington when Joe Welch, who was a Boston lawyer, a Brahmin lawyer from Boston, was in front of the committee to talk about the business that was at hand, which had to do with Roy Cohn, counsel to Joe McCarthy. Let's not go there. But what happened in that hearing is that McCarthy decided that he wanted to try to undermine Joe Welch. And so he began talking about a young lawyer in Joe Welch's firm named Fred Fisher. Fred Fisher had initially been asked by Welch to come in and assist him in the hearings. But before inviting him, he said to Fred Fisher, "Let's be sure there's nothing in your past that could be used against you." And Fisher said, "Well, I have to be honest with you. I was a member of the Lawyers Guild, which people thought was a communist front organization." And Welch said to him, "Then you better not come. I love you. You're a wonderful guy. I want you to have a long career. I don't want you to be taken apart." And so Fisher was sent back to Boston. But McCarthy decided to go after Fred Fisher by name. And it was the exchange that took place, which we'll play a part of. Got to listen carefully. It's a little hard to hear some of it. Had a lot to do with McCarthy's downfall. And you will hear in this exchange the famous phrase that Joe Welch used that some people are using about Donald Trump today.
"I think we should tell him that he has in his law firm a young man named Fisher, whom he recommended incidentally to do the work in this committee, who has been for a number of years a member of an organization which was named, years and years ago, as the legal bulwark of the Communist Party. I certainly assume that Mr. Welch did not know of this young man at the time he recommended him as the assistant counsel for this committee. I thought we should just call your attention to the fact that your Mr. Fisher, who is still in your law firm today, whom you asked to have down here looking over the secret and classified material, is a member of an organization not named by me, but named by various committees, named by the Attorney General, as I recall. He belonged to it long after it had been exposed as the legal arm of the Communist Party. Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness. Little did I dream you could be so reckless and so cruel as to do an injury to that lad. If it were in my power to forgive you for your reckless cruelty, I would do so. I like to think I'm a gentleman, but your forgiveness will have to come from someone other than me.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. Look, you've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?"
That's Joe Welch and Joe McCarthy having at it. Jim Galloway, that hearing was carried live by the Dumont Television Network and by the new network, ABC, at the time. And it really was the beginning of the undoing of Joe McCarthy.
It was, and it was. We didn't see anything else like it until the Watergate hearings some two decades later, because this was a kind of a mid-afternoon broadcast, if I recall.
That's exactly right.
Let me, a couple distinctions and similarities that we need to point out here. Number one, of course, what Donald Trump has been doing, and the Khazar Khan controversy, that's all been kind of on the political side. It was not governmental operations. This was what happened with the House Un-American Activities Committee. Well, no, I'm sorry, this was a Senate committee. This was all about government operations. In this case, I think McCarthy was investigating communist infiltration
in the military. Exactly.
Right. But another something else that needs to be drawn out, that the McCarthy's advisor. Oh no! The House Un-American Activities Committee advisor. I think Bobby Kennedy was on that at the time.
Yes,
but he was working under a fellow named Roy Kahn.
Roy Cohn was actually working next to Joe McCarthy. But Roy Cohn became, he was the reason for all of this, Roy Cohn was alleged to have used his job to help a friend of his, who may have been a lover, there were a lot of homosexual undertones to this, get a position in government. And that led to all of this.
Right. And Roy Cohn, of course, was Donald Trump's mentor.
Yes.
And kind of taught him the means of communication via attack. You know, you attack, and all publicity is good publicity. But what I want to get to here is that what they have in common, the McCarthy incident and what we're seeing right now, what they have in common is you've got a politician out there that's been very, very talented about building a political frame and creating this version of reality that is suddenly put into another context, and that frame is removed, and you have a whole new audience looking at it and saying, oh my goodness, where are we going?
That is precisely you are completely right. That's the one reason this is sort of relevant. Whether you think that Joe McCarthy in this case was correct or Joe Welch was correct, that is exactly right. It put Joe McCarthy put a new lens on him for people who may not have ever paid much attention. And that's what the Kahn incident seems to have done for Donald Trump. And that line, "Have you at long last no sense of decency," is a line that some people have tried to use now with Donald Trump in relation to all this. Tamara or Aaron, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I think that I've been saying for a long time that the truest thing spoken in this campaign was when Donald Trump said a while ago that he could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and not lose a single supporter. And I always thought that was true. But I think that maybe is changing now. You're seeing a lot of people going, taking deep step backs away from Donald Trump after the Kahn incident.
So we've spent virtually this entire show talking about Trump, and for good reason. He has dominated the news since the convention, which in this case, he always says, all publicity is good publicity. Not so much. But the reality is, tomorrow, that this has allowed some of the problems that Hillary Clinton is going to have to confront at some point in this race to go fly completely under the radar. We had a report, a jobs report, this past week that wasn't particularly promising. The economy is slowing down. Trump has not dealt with that. It isn't as if this race is over, and we are probably going to at some point have to do some shows talking about all the challenges Hillary Clinton faces in terms of her own biography and her own work in government. Yes?
Yes, but in the meantime, every interview that Trump staffers have to give where they're defending Trump's conduct is a missed opportunity where they could have been talking about something Clinton might have done. You know, we're just seeing news about a payout to Iran right after they had briefly taken custody of some American soldiers. You know, they were trying to, the Trump campaign wanted to talk about that clearly, but, you know, all this news about all these perceived gaffes overtook that. So until they can flip the narrative, start controlling the message, these are missed opportunities left and right.
Let me share with you, Ted B says, he's responding, he says, "Trump's defamed Kahn seems a bit of a stretch. He hinted that wife was not allowed to speak and that Kahn attacked him seems pretty mild." Okay. And then someone else tweeted, Richard Flynn tweeted, "How can I even suggest that Joe McCarthy may have been correct? I hope I didn't say that. I think I said there are some people who did think he was correct and others who didn't, but fair enough." I think that's a fair comment. Aaron, this story about the payout of $400 million appeared in the Wall Street Journal this morning, and the Journal article and certainly the Trump campaign are suggesting that this was essentially paying blackmail to the Iranians to get back our sailors. The interesting thing about that is this story, the New York Times reported this story months ago, and the Journal, I didn't see any new information, new reporting in the story today.
No, I didn't either. That really struck me. I had to go back and find that New York Times story from when the deal was signed that came out, And it was pretty clear then that they sent $400 million that they said was owed to Iran for an arms deal back when the Shah was still around that the U.S. never paid because they didn't get a chance because the revolution happened and the Shah was deposed.
Yeah, you know, given all that, you can see very clearly that this is going to be an opportunity for the Trump campaign to go after Obama and Clinton.
So I signed up for the Trump campaign's text. They sent out text alerts to people all the time. And they sent one just before we went on air that said, failed Obama-Hillary policy update. First a bad nuclear deal with Iran. Now a secret payoff of $400 million was airlifted to Iran. Really bad.
Okay, well, there you go. And under normal circumstances, that would be getting a lot of attention, as Tamar points out.
Right. And you have to remember that also that Hillary Clinton was on Fox News on Sunday and told what you have to say was a pretty darn big whopper.
Misrepresented everything she said about the email and the FBI investigation.
She says our FBI director had said that she had been entirely truthful. about her emails and email servers, when that's not the case at all. And but again, because Mr. Trump is stepping on his own news here, then that he's creating the agenda.
All right. I got a minute and a half to talk about a story that we promoted at the beginning of the show. Hank Johnson, Tamar. Hank Johnson is in some trouble. He compared West Bank settlers, Israelis who have moved to the West Bank and settled in Palestinian territory, to termites. And he can't get out from under this one, can he?
We'll see what ends up happening. He's been meeting with Jewish and pro-Israel groups this week, apologizing, trying to make it better. We're going to see from them whether they buy his apology. The initial react has been fairly positive. The Atlanta Jewish Times earlier this week said that they appreciated that his apology seemed sincere. But the real question, they said, is what he was doing speaking at this event in the first place, at a group that promotes divesting in Israeli products.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
The Anti-Defamation League said it was offensive. I'm interested, Tamar, in your reporting on this, that the Jewish organizations seem to be willing to give him something of I don't know if a break is the right word, but seem to try. They want to be understanding, I guess, is a fair way to say it, right?
Yeah, what's going to be interesting is the next time around, the next time he faces a primary challenge, potentially in 2 years, whether we'll see a Democratic candidate appeal to pro-Israel forces.
Exactly. And by the way, as I guess we put a punctuation mark, a period on this, we say, oh, remember, this is a seat once held by Cynthia McKinney,
right,
who I think most Jewish organizations consider one of the most anti-Semitic members of the United States Congress. Hank Johnson has a long way to go, I imagine, before any Jewish organization would call him that. Look, we are completely out of time on today's Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman, Washington correspondent for the AJC, thank you so much for joining us by phone. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
Aaron Gould Shinen, thank you for coming in today. And Jim Galloway, you as well. Friday, you're coming back, and we're going to get to have the first look at the poll, presidential poll that the AJC is taking of Georgia voters.
Ooh, stay tuned.
Mark Roundtree of Landmark Communications, who's also polling, will be here as well. So we got to have a great conversation about polling. That's it for us. Our producer, our senior producer, Jenny Amond. Our producer, Trevor Young. Our board operator is Tyler Morris. Hannah Rose Adams is in the booth helping keep this show on its tracks. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again Friday at 3:00.